I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine. I'm Levy Dalton, and this is All Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the wine business. David Lilly takes a moment out of a busy wine buyer's schedule to join us and tell us a little bit about what is one of the most fascinating retailer histories in the business. David brings a phenomenal amount of knowledge to the subject and is someone that I personally find to be a huge inspiration in his work at Chamber Street Wines in Tribeca in Manhattan. Somebody I'm always pleased to take a moment to listen to, and I hope you will too. So we're here today with David Lilly, and David is really an icon in the retail world. Now, come on, you are. Come on. In the retail world, he
founded... I hate the word icon. That's a really awful word. Well, yeah, don't use that again. I'm going to get really mad. Scratch that.
Is the owner and founder, co-founder and co-owner of Chamber Street Wines on Chamber Street in Tribeca in Manhattan. And it's a business that he founded in 2001.
So you started
in 2001, and it was Tribeca, Manhattan, and maybe that was somewhat of a difficult time. Is that possible?
Yeah, but Jamie Wolf, who is my partner, co-owner, felt very strongly that that was a good location. He had to convince me, and the place was available, and that was really fortunate for us to find a space that had been a store that had failed, and... Maybe I was a little nervous about, you know, okay, why had the store failed?
Sure.
Jamie was convinced that the neighborhood would support us. And we had the beginnings of a national clientele already in place from my years at the previous shop at Garnet.
Oh, okay.
So I was pretty confident that we had... a concept that would work, that we, that, you know, we knew who our clients would be. So I think it was a relatively safe bet for us, despite my misgivings about the neighborhood. No one, of course, could see that 9/11 was coming, but that, and that was difficult. It was difficult, you know, on any number of levels. I didn't really think about the business aspect until a week later, and Joe Dressner called me up and said, "Oh man, you may lose your business." And I said, "Joe, I hadn't really thought of that." didn't think of stuff like that.
Right.
It was so shocking. And if you were down there when it happened, it was so emotionally wrenching that you just didn't think of that. So,
do you think that the community down there kind of grew stronger in the years following in terms of supporting neighborhood businesses?
A little bit, yeah, I think so. I mean, people were aware that we stuck it out, and, you know, my son was out there making deliveries soon after, you know, which was probably not a good idea. The people that live in the traditional areas of Tribeca just to our north, and then the new people that came in, you know, 2, 3, 4 years later started to really come in and populate the new buildings to the west of us. I don't think they really had that much of an idea about it, but they've accepted us as the neighborhood store. Whether they realize what we're doing or not, they're happy with the wines, and so they support us. But yeah, I think there was some sense, at least in the people that had been in Tribeca for many years, that we had arrived, we stuck it out, and so they were faithful to us for sure. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the wine side and what people may not realize you're doing or may realize you're doing and follow it closely. You know, I'd love to hear more about the conversation that started with you and the Loire Valley and Beaujolais and finding small growers, maybe not so long ago were almost unknown in America. How did you end up kind of searching through the Loire and finding producers like Claude Rochebon?
Well, it goes way back to basically going to France with my wife. I loved wine. I was a musician. I couldn't afford anything that was more than $2.99. And I used to shop at Astor and buy cheap Portuguese wine and cheap Bordeaux. And I was fascinated by it, but I didn't think of it as a career.
And you were in a jazz band at that time.
Yeah. My wife had lived in France for 3 or 4 years and was not any sort of a wine aficionado, but knew people in the Loire Valley and liked the wine. So when first time I went to France with my wife in 78, we started drinking Chenal and Bourgogne that we bought in Paris at the markets. And I didn't know any better. I thought it was terrific and
sure.
It was cheap. And
yeah, the Loire is traditionally a big supplier to Paris bistros,
yeah,
right?
Sure. What was the first year? I guess it was 81. We decided to visit the Loire Valley and more seriously, and we spent some time in Vouvray, and luckily enough happened to be staying up the road from François Pinel, or from his parents. François was in Tours at the time working as a psychologist.
Sure. So he makes a little Vouvray.
Yes. So we met his parents in 1981, and we visited some people in Saint-Nicolas de Bourgogne and some people. We started drinking Muscadet in restaurants. I just thought, hey, these are delicious. I didn't really think about doing anything with it. I just thought it was a lot of fun. I thought the people were really super nice and the region was beautiful. So it wasn't until, the music business failed to support my three kids that, I needed a job.
Yeah.
So I got a job at Garnett in the fall of 86, I guess it was.
So this is the Upper East Side on Lexington, wine shop.
Yeah, which at that time, it wasn't long after pricing had been deregulated. It was a very sort of wild and crazy retail world back then.
Got it. What are some of the things that we would have seen back then that would be kind of unthinkable now in terms of how things happen on a day-to-day basis?
Well, there was a lot of competition on the discount end. I mean, that's what Garnett was doing, and they were I don't know if despised is the right word, but the old guard of the wine business, the Sherry Laymans and of the world were shocked. I mean, they'd had this sort of elitist small world for years, which had been working fine, and the profits were very good, and all of a sudden there were new shops opening up that were discounting fine wines. That was really, I may have the dates a little wrong, but I think that really started happening first in the early 80s.
Got it.
So when I joined Garnett, they were discounting Bordeaux heavily.
So it was more of a volume model.
That was definitely a volume model.
You didn't want to sit on the stock too long. You wanted to send it out at a lower price. And
yeah.
The savings were a factor of how long you didn't have to sit on the stock. Like, in other words, other people might have charged more because they were sitting on the items
everything,
for longer.
You turned over vast quantities of stuff very quickly. And this was sort of a new model, I think, in the wine business in New York. It was all tied in with the arrival of Robert Parker, the ability of people that didn't really know much about wine to purchase by numbers, in Bordeaux. I mean, this is really centered around the Bordeaux trade.
Got it.
And so, that's what I learned that stuff. I studied the Wine Advocate, and when I before I got the job at Garnet, I spent a month on a cruise ship that was my last long music job, and I was like memorizing the Parker reviews. So I would sound like I knew what I was talking about,
right. You know,
which was...
Well, I spent a lot of time doing that too.
Right. So, in that sense, Parker really helped open up the market to everybody and
sure.
really sort of opened the world up to what came later. So
you're saying that the influence of newsletters and numbers allowed Grüner Veltliner to become the Pinot Grigio of the wine world, allowed small kind of niche items to get a broad awareness because people were... you know, kind of less intimidated by wine in a way and willing to give a chance to something that had a high number attached.
Right. And while that was going on at Garnet, they were doing this huge volume. I was researching as best I could the Loire Valley, Beaujolais, parts of France I was interested in. And
this is because of your wife's...
Originally, for sure.
You'd met a couple people in that region through her and... You just kind of, you were into it.
I just thought it was fascinating. And the people were so interesting.
What was the retail outlook for a Chinon in 83?
Well, there wasn't any, but that, it took a little while.
Yeah.
When I started at Garnet, there was one Muscadet and a Sancerre, and that was about it. I think the first time I went to France with the intent of sourcing wine was with Alain Jeanneney, who had been sourcing wines in the Rhone Valley, Rhone, mostly based on Parker scores.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah. Well,
I associate him like Bono and stuff. So
yeah. Well. Yeah, I was with Alan when we the first meeting with Bono, and Alan was going 240 kilometers an hour down the A6. I was terrified. He had been a rally driver, so he was.
Oh, is that true? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he had been a
rally driver. I see him only as this kind of older, dignified gentleman behind the table who doesn't talk much.
He's crazy behind the wheel.
I didn't realize the anarchist.
In Beaujolais, you can imagine going around up and down the hills and around the curves in Beaujolais. He would sort of. Break violently, twist the frame, and just swing like I can't describe how race car drivers do what they do, but
sure.
it was terrifying. Anyway, so Alan became interested in maybe we can do something in the Loire Valley because I'd been talking it up, and we met an agent there that introduced us to some people, and I had some names, and it didn't work.
Got it.
We started with Olga Raffo. We started with Joel Talluo, Pierre-Jacques Drouet, people like that. I brought it in for Garnet.
And it was kind of like a DI model. You just kind of sent it out a newsletter, or you're just sort of hand-selling?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hand-selling. I mean, the wines were terrific, but...
I mean, because this is before the era of the email blast.
Right. This was like the 88 vintage, which was sort of an earthy vintage in the Loire Valley. It wasn't really easy to sell.
Olga 88's pretty rough and tough.
I went out to the West Coast with Alan, with a French sommelier, to try to sell the wines on the West Coast, and people were appalled.
Uh-huh. How many times were you called a lunatic?
Where's the fruit? What is this? What? There was a total lack of comprehension. So
phenolic ripeness wasn't exactly...
That didn't work out too well. So happily...
Were there any pitchforks involved, or did things...
Just a lot of embarrassment.
Right.
But happily after that, well, there was also a guy in the Loire Valley, an American agent that was shipping stuff. So we started buying Bernard Baudry, who was just starting back then, really.
Wow. And at this point, anybody would say he's one of the top producers, maybe in the whole Loire, certainly in Chino.
But then fortunately, the whole thing turned on meeting Joe Dresner. Because, Joe had started to work in Burgundy. He and Denise had gotten allocations from people like Paul Pernod and other growers in Burgundy.
George Lignier.
And we're shopping them in New York. And J.R. Battipaglia, who was my friend, and he was the owner's son at Garnet, who was buying Burgundy, started to buy from the Dresners. Joe had already started working. I think he had just started with Jean-Paul Brun, and Jean-Paul had said, you should taste with Marc Olivier, because they had shared a stand at a show, I forget where. And so Joe brought samples of Marc Olivier, and
which is you know, at this point a well-known Muscadet producer, but at the time,
right,
probably no one knew.
And we had just started to work with Domaine Louvetry,
okay,
who
sure.
was coming through Jean-Marie Deschamps back then. So I had had an idea that there was better Muscadet out there.
Yeah, well, those are some of them, right? Yeah, there. Yeah, those are some of the sure. top, you know.
Joe brought a bottle of Pepierre, and I said, yeah, I'll take 50 cases. That,
you know, yeah, he's just like, come in. So, I mean, what for you, I mean, you may just kind of have assumed this as a given, but what for you would be the difference between a good Muscadet and a so-so Muscadet? I mean, what are some of the differences in how it's produced, what kind of volume we're talking about, and the taste profile? What would be different?
Well, when I was first tasting them back then, I really had no idea. I just knew that it tasted good.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew this was a good glass of wine. I mean, yeah. I didn't really know why.
Sure.
Looking back on it, it's pretty obvious why. I mean, Marc was fermenting with wild yeast, which very few people were doing. He was hand harvesting, which was non-existent in Muscadet at the time.
Everyone was using machine harvesters.
Everyone. And you know, we had old vines, Marcel selection vines. You know, I mean, I didn't know that any of that stuff at the
sure.
time. I just thought the wine was terrific. So
did Marc know? I mean, he knew.
Yes, he knew what he was doing. He didn't. I mean, the way he explains it, the choice to work without added yeasts was just, well, I saw that I didn't need them,
yeah,
and I thought the wine was better without.
Right.
So it wasn't. He wasn't in touch with a bunch of wine geeks that said you should work wild yeast. He just
right.
sort of came to that conclusion himself.
And it wasn't a cabal of wine writers no. on the East Coast telling
well,
people
he
they
was,
had to use wild yeast.
At some point, he became friends with André-Michel Bregion, who throughout the dark period in the Muscadet was hand harvesting, not adding sulfur at the crush, you know, vinifying naturally, and so
how
there
long
were,
would
there
you
were people doing that
say
then.
The dark period lasted? Like, how long was the kind of commercial cheap model of Muscadet dominant? Are we talking about a few decades there? I mean, would you say?
I think starting in the 60s. I mean,
60s.
You know, the whole conversion to total chimique in France happened more in the 60s into the 70s. I mean, Muscadet was sort of a backwater. They didn't really go totally mechanical. Maybe it was after other people did. But,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it was happening everywhere, not just in the Muscadet. But,
sure. But it seems like the, you know, maybe because it's a backwater, we still see it coming out of that as opposed to it's fully, you know, we
yeah.
don't, you can't just go to the market, pick any Muscadet anytime and feel like you're going to get a artisanal product. It seems like if you know certain, you know, you have to follow certain growers, a lot of whom you've been associated with bringing in or writing about or selling at the retail level. But, you know, if you're not on that kind of short list, then things drop off quality-wise pretty quickly. It seems.
But since the Loire Valley was not a commercially important region and there was you know, still a huge number of small family estates, they were not so prone to take up the abuses of Bordeaux or Beaujolais or other regions that
sure.
were doing volume. And
maybe didn't have the money to like buy new
right.
harvesters
sure.
and that kind of thing. So you started bringing in some things from the Loire, and Joe was bringing in some things from Beaujolais. You mentioned Brune. What was kind of the next progression after that? What happened?
Well, we started buying quite a bit of wine from Joe that, you know, the early estates, included Jean-Paul Brun for sure. Joe thought it would be a good idea to travel together and see what we could come up with. And I got, you know, used some vacation time at Garnett.
Sure.
You know, we had a lot of names. I had a lot of people that I wanted to see, and Joe had the interest. And, you know, it was sort of crazy on his part because there was really no indication this was going to work financially except that we had a market for it at Garnett, but beyond that, you know, obviously he would need more than that to sell the wine. So Joe was taking an enormous gamble in spending the time and effort into sourcing wines like that. So,
in the early days, you guys drive up And what are you looking for when you sit down with a grower? I mean, there's a lot of people who mm-hmm. make wine in France, you know.
Well, we had a pretty good list that, you know, we had gone through and
from growers you liked, who gave you other
from
names.
From growers we knew from just cross-referencing the French press for years, from talking to other people in the region. We had a good idea of who we wanted to see in the first trip or two. But it quickly opened up a whole world to us that I didn't know existed. And I think, you know, it was just a time when there was changes were starting to happen in the vineyards, and young people were starting to work more naturally. And it was a lot of fun.
So when you say work more naturally, what does that mean? And how might one discern a difference in terms of the finished taste?
Well, I think when Joe and I were, this all will seem sort of naive to anyone that had been in the business before. And certainly there were, you know, great importers working very knowledgeably with good producers for years. I mean, Joe and I were both quite naive at the time. So for us, it was.
I consider my naivete part of my charm.
Yeah,
I don't know about you.
Of course. It took a while before we started asking things like, okay, wild yeasts. I remember tasting at the Salon Vin de Loire every Chardonnay producer, and mm-hmm. Joe and I tasted independently, and then at the end of the afternoon we compared notes, and well, we liked Francois Cazin. He turns out he harvests by hand and he vinifies with wild yeasts, and you know, we began to get the idea that these were wines we liked. We didn't go there with a manifesto of this is the way we want people to work. We tasted with a lot of growers and realized that the people that were making the wines we liked were working that way. So that became the key to us to asking those questions. And I remember someone in the wine business getting mad at me for, it's wrong to ask those kind of questions up front, you know, when you're
Yeah,
when
I remember
you're
that
someone.
Came up a couple of years ago.
And I said, well, you know, I mean, we like to know the people. We like to feel that they're people that we want to work with. We like to know how they work.
Yeah.
It's all part of it. I mean,
well, nobody gives Ferrari a hard time for making handcrafted cars, right? No one's like, oh, you're not using an assembly line. You know, it's thought of as a good thing, I think.
But the idea that if you taste a wine and you can sell it, then you shouldn't worry about how it's made.
Which was, let's be honest, pretty common in the 90s. It was like kind of a go-go thing. Like, hey, it's moving. You know?
But in the aromatics of a wine, you can usually tell whether it's, at least in the Loire Valley, at that point in my experience, okay, is this yeasted or not?
And So you can tell.
If it was yeasted, the aromas were sort of cloying and simple. And
it was a simple. I mean, obviously yeast have changed, kind of like filters have changed. They've gotten more complex in terms of the ability to culture yeast. But you think and you feel that you can see the difference. I'm asking because I think other people would be asking, so I'm asking.
Sure. I can't claim to...
In terms of a taste and smell
to,
level.
To say I could tell you that with every wine,
sure.
That is it or is it not. But
yeah. But you think...
I don't
you
consider
feel
myself to be a particularly talented wine taster, but I think that it's fairly obvious and the difference is quite large.
Well, in the past, I've found that I quite enjoy the wines that you recommend, so I feel like you're certainly... And I've actually seen you be quite a patient taster, so I think you're not giving yourself enough credit, but...
But at the same time, so we began to realize that the wines we liked were coming from organically tended vineyards.
Got it.
Or people that were at least in work, moving in that direction.
Sure.
And, you know, the more we read about it, the more important that became to us to find people that were working organic, biodynamic, whether they were certified or not, that they were working with living soils. The whole idea of living soils is sort of, you know, it's a huge part of making a real food product, no matter what it is, not just wine.
I've heard
whether
some
it's cheese,
say,
whether
sure.
it's, you know, whatever. And, you know, that whole idea was in any sort of commercial wine region, they regard the soil as sort of this inert substance that you you know, water is the main importance, and then you can fertilize, and, you know, what's the big deal?
So it's rain and drainage, but no
rain, drainage, sunlight. I mean, it's the sort of California theory of what makes great wine. And indeed, if you want to make a wine of fruit, that's fine. That's all you need. But if you want to make a wine of terroir, you need terroir, and you need to have, really, if you want to make great wine, in my opinion, you need living soil. And okay, you can say in Bordeaux they make all kinds of great wines. You know, most of the great Bordeaux are still made on chemically treated vineyards. And it's true, I think, that after 20 or 30 years, when the wines are totally secondary, okay, the difference is maybe not as important. Perhaps that's true. But
when they mature, when they're fully mature.
I don't really accept that argument myself. But
got it. Oh, I mean, it's hard to tell because the wines that are fully mature now are probably not as chemically treated when they were younger. You know what I mean?
Right. So anyway, I mean, so Joe and I started, you know, crisscrossing the Loire Valley, Beaujolais, and it was we didn't have any money. We were sharing rooms in crappy hotels or staying on the growers' floors or whatever. And it was intensely interesting. And
maybe you could tell us a little bit. I mean, you knew him quite well. Obviously, he's recently passed away. Not to belabor the point too much, but I mean, what are some of the things that you really remember about Joe, this person that has, by sort of sheer personality, seemingly reached many people in the wine business? What are some of the things that you would have summed up this man? You know, he was a little bit of a chameleon figure at times. I think people had a hard time understanding exactly what he would mean by certain things he said, because sometimes it would seem abrasive to them. You know, for instance, but he also was incredibly, incredibly funny and quite tender in certain moments too. What are some of the memories that really stood out for you of, because you were probably one of his closest friends and business partners?
Well, he was a guy that was great fun to be with. I mean, he was intensely intelligent and could talk knowledgeably about all kinds of things, not just wine. We wouldn't just talk about wine, you know. I guess for me, yeah, it was just very stimulating to work with him, to travel with him. He was, as you say, intensely funny. You couldn't take seriously most of what he said because it was meant as humor, and it was remarkably humorous. And even in those days when, I mean, he always, being married to a French woman and spending a lot of time in France, his French grammatically was fairly good, but his accent remained awful throughout his life. but he was able to communicate very quickly with growers and recognize who he wanted to work with and who... Not just that he wanted to work with them, but which of the growers were doing what they were doing because they had to, just because it was what they loved doing, and because it was, and this was what turned him on. You know, this is what was important to him, was to find people that were working in that sense. He was very short with growers who had commercial wine that was, you know, I mean, we would taste with people at the salon, and Joe was very good at instantly leaving a tasting that was obviously headed the wrong direction, where I was always sort of more polite and would waste time tasting through someone's line of stuff that was obviously not what we were looking for. I think it was the main thing that I remember about Joe was this rapport with the growers that was so deep and could develop so quickly. And case in point would be Clos Roche Blanche, when we were, and finding Clos Roche was really came out of the Salon Vendôme, which was a great resource for us in the early years anyway. I had the idea that we could find a good Touraine Sauvignon, and that the price points would be, you know, I was looking at it as a retailer, you know.
Sure, you wanted a varietal Sauvignon
and,
Blanc.
You know, Joe didn't always look at things like that. He rarely looked at things like that. You know, if the grower had no wine to sell, and it was all the better, you know, if it was some unsellable, totally uncommercial wine, that was what he was happiest with. So I think having me along was sort of, it was good for him because...
Balance.
Okay, let's find something I can sell.
Right.
Someone told Joe, oh, you should go taste with Catherine and Didier. So when we, you know, I remember just sort of walking up to their stand and seeing them, wow, okay, these are interesting looking people.
Yeah.
This looks great. And the wines were sensational. And it was actually fairly shortly after they had started conversion to BO, and they were still finding their way, but the wine was terrific. And meeting them and becoming instantly good friends with them was, again, sort of opened up this world to us of people working that way in the Loire Valley, which was starting at that time.
Didier is really famous within the certain people who know his story well in terms of... using fennel to fight cryptogamic disease. Maybe you could just kind of talk a little bit about that and what he did. And
he's an amazingly intelligent guy that's done all sorts of hands-on research about what works in the vineyard, what doesn't. And it's amazing. You know, you come in, you visit people like this in France, and guys like Didier Barrier doing this amazing research totally without support of any kind.
Sure, it's not like he works for a university.
Yeah, I mean, what chemical company is going to support research that puts them out of business? I mean,
sure.
There's no, yeah. Or you would think within France there would be more of a concerted effort to support that sort of research that enables people to farm organically.
Sure.
I mean, no one's really found a dependable organic way to combat rot and mildew. So they're forced to use copper sulfate, which is bad for the earthworms.
Right. And that's, that's maybe some of the reason why we see organic and biodynamic wines often in areas where it's a little drier.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an argument that growers use against organic farming. Well, I don't want to go that way
lose
because
everything to rot.
I don't want to have to use copper sulfate. I mean,
right.
Maybe that's sort of an excuse. But anyway, so... Didier, it's years and years of trial and error. What kind of plants work to attract the insects that are beneficial in the vineyard? What kind of flowers? What kind of plants work between the rows? What kind of plants have deep root systems that will compete with and aerate the soil? Compete with the vine and aerate the soil? I mean, it's fascinating stuff, and Didier has been in the forefront of doing that kind of work, along with, particularly in the early days, Francois Chiden, people like that. And it's it's a huge area of research and interest that's surprisingly not well communicated among growers. I mean, there's the AVN where growers will get together and they'll talk about stuff like that, but. You know, people in the Beaujolais don't know about Didier Barrier, what he's doing in the Loire Valley. He doesn't know about what someone's doing in Jurançon or what's, you know, so it's sort of...
One of the things that Kevin McKenna told me once, who's, Joe's former partner, and he runs Louis Dresner Selections along with Joe's widow, Denise, is he said that the thing he's probably most proud of is getting the growers to talk to each other about what they're doing. Yeah. And that he thinks that interaction has been better than anything he's done in terms of what we've seen from it. Like young growers like Acapinti kind of leaping forward because of the knowledge that they gained talking to other growers on trips that they all took together when they would show together, but then also when they would all come to America together, because Joe always had this vision of bringing over all the growers and getting them and having them behind the tables to meet with the buyers, which is rare. I mean, usually you see a few growers, and maybe you see a lot of sales representatives and people who work for larger wineries, but you don't necessarily see a small importer bringing over 30, 35 people who are all small growers who rarely leave their own vineyards to come meet with the actual buyers in New York or in Seattle or in San Francisco. And that's something that Joe frequently does, and all these growers know each other because of that, all the growers in a portfolio. Is that Is that, have you seen that change as well, where people kind of get a chance to talk to each other and maybe pick up a piece of, parcel of knowledge that they wouldn't have known?
It's hugely important to them. I mean, they and there's this great rapport among most of the growers that work with Louis Dressner that share that the stories, the knowledge they have. It's really fun and interesting to be part of that. I remember when Marc Olivier first came to the U.S. He'd never been in an airplane before. And
is that true?
Yeah. He was super excited about coming to New York, and it remains something that he looks forward to really every year. I mean, the year that was of the volcano a few years back, when they couldn't come, he was really upset. They get together, they talk, they share what they're doing.
And I remember it was very small scale. I mean, it used to be like, hey, we need a place, somebody's couch that Marc Olivier can crash on, or where can Didier stay, you know, with a friend. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like anybody was getting put up at any kind of hotel, let alone a 5-star hotel.
Well, Mark likes staying with us. You know, he likes hanging out in the kitchen in the morning, and he's such a deep guy. It's great fun to have him in the house. And he put up Joe and I in the early years. That was one way we could afford it. We would stay with Mark and drive back and forth to... to the Pénantais from his place, and he was just so totally generous and supportive of us in the beginning. So yeah, the relationship with Marc Olivier has been very important, and with Jean-Paul Brun, who did the same thing. We always stayed at his place. So yeah, meeting people like that was super important. And for me, just it's the attitude that these growers have toward what they do is so amazingly refreshing and real. You know, in a world where everything is based on sales and commercial this and promotions and to find people that just do what they do because they have to, because they want to, and who are totally outside of that world, it's remarkable. And so helping to bring that to the American consumer and helping these people economically, okay, it's not, you know, it's you know, that's not the reason we do it, maybe, but it certainly is to me. I mean, it's such an interesting world, and it's so much fun to be involved with it.
And that seems to be kind of the vision behind the shop, in terms of, you know, we want to help small growers find a market mm-hmm. for what they're doing, because we want to be able to support them. What would you say about the shop and what your work is?
I think Jamie and I just both went into it as how can we make a living doing what we want to do, you know, what importing wines that we like, working with people that we enjoy working with, and it's worked out, and I think it was...
But it's interesting that you say make a living, because it wasn't like you said, how can we make a killing? You know, it's not like you guys went big scale and you wanted to make sales. And in fact, you know, that idea may be even a little bit... ridiculous to you, even
right.
saying that.
I think we were both aware that this was not a way to get rich. I mean, no one's that's totally outside of the idea
model of the deal. Right.
And even now, it's not you know, with the expenses of operating the store and the staff. We have this fabulous staff, but we unfortunately have to pay them. And
they're still asking you for that.
Yeah. So no, it's not. No, it's sort of it's this niche that's outside of the commercial wine world, and it's nice. It's a nice niche.
But a lot of people look to you as guys who did it, like who say, "Wow, you really are able to carry the wines that you like, and kind of apart from just kind of concerns about selling. You know, there's an idea you have a connection with these people, and that you really know the wines quite well, and these are the wines you sell. But at the same time, it's been successful, and I think a lot of young people getting into retail trade are like, wow, you know, if they can do it, I can do it. Mm. Let me sell wines that I really like.
Well, you have to run a retail store. You still have to be aware of the realities of the business, what you can and can't do. I mean,
so what would you say to that young person about what you can and can't do? I mean, what are some of those realities?
Well, it depends on how big you want to be. I mean, I think Jamie and I are pretty comfortable with the size of the shop right now, with the amount of business we do. But, you know, we have to be aware that there are people in our community that walk in the store every day that don't really want a biodynamic Nocelle for Beaujolais.
Right. So not everybody's coming in saying, I want natural wine.
Most of them will drink it and like it if we give it to them. Yeah. But, you know, we do stock some wines that don't fall into that category. So, however, in this day and age, I think it's possible to run a store on a small scale that is completely focused on, and there are people doing it, and you know, which is great, focused on biodynamic natural wines. There's a market for it. It's not going to be a big living, but it can be done. I mean, there are numerous stores in Brooklyn, wherever, that are working on that model. That are, I don't know how they're doing economically. I hope they're doing well. But for us, you know, we're competing nationally, but competing is really the wrong word, because we're putting stuff out there that most people don't have.
Right. Or they're kind of like the one guy who has.
Only a few other shops have it. It's fun, you know, it's fun writing emails and sending them out and getting response from all over the country from people that would like to try these wines. And so we have, you know, regular customers all over the country, and that's a lot of fun.
So what would you say to maybe the person coming in off the street who isn't necessarily looking for bio kind of wines and doesn't know about the natural wine conversions that are happening amongst conversations that are happening in France or in Italy? Say they were to approach one of these wines, you know, having come from a background of trying wines that are very different, maybe from the New World, what would you say to that person?
I'd say try this. It's a delicious bottle of wine.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want to give them too much information because they glaze over pretty quickly. You know, you want the customer to try it. So you express your enthusiasm.
But what if they said, "Gee, this doesn't smell like anything I've had before"? What would you say then? Like, just seems pretty different. How would you maybe talk about that with that person?
It doesn't happen that frequently, really.
Okay. And do you think that's because, you know, retail, you're not there when they open it, or?
No, I think there are certain wines that we know are going to cause that reaction. Let's say wines that are overtly somewhat oxidative, or wines that have a little bit too much schizo yeasts involved, so the aromas are too funky, and you know, you have to know your customer, and so you don't give the guy who walks in off the street that bottle of wine. Maybe you work them up to that, and if they come in and say, "Yeah, I really like that sort of that interesting aromatic," you know, I've never tasted a wine like that. Then you kind of take it to the next level.
Yeah,
I mean. The Ducru Beaujolais Renier, it's biodynamique, there's no sulfur, but it doesn't have a lot of off aromas. There's
sure.
basically no bread.
Pretty delicious wine.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, as an aside on that part of the wine world, you know, it was fashionable in France some years back to start up your winery and work without sulfur. And as Pierre Auvernois said in an interview with Francois Morel, you know, it's one thing to work without sulfur, but then you have to taste the results. You know, you have to know what you're doing. It takes the ability to cool the vats. It takes equipment. Some people do it with a great deal of analysis. The guys in the Beaujolais that are working with low sulfur. Frequently, they're doing constant analysis to make sure of what's going on. Of course, there are guys like Ducru or Pierre Frick who don't analyze anything, who just...
Is that true? They just let it roll?
Yeah. They just taste it. You know, I mean, if it's working without sulfur, they don't add sulfur. Ducru never adds sulfur, but, I mean, Frick will add sulfur to whites if he feels that the wine can't support it. But he'll just draw off a glass and leave it for a few days or a week or whatever, and if the wine holds up, he'll say, "Yes, you know, I can bottle this without sulfur." There was a trend there for a while, which still exists, and there's a lot of it in the Roussillon and the Loire, to make wine without sulfur because that's the way they feel the wine should be made, and the results are not always so great. I don't agree that the consumer should have an obligation to drink wine like that. I mean, I think that's, I think it's a great direction for people to go in. I think, you know, I really have a lot of respect for growers that are trying to work without sulfur. But in terms of bringing the wine to the U.S. and presenting it to the consumer, you have to be a little bit careful. I mean, so
there's a responsibility there.
Yeah.
Where do you see the trends going in the next few years? I mean, talked a little bit about what's been going on. What do you see happening, you know, at the kind of grassroots level with these growers, or things might change over the next 10 years? What's next?
That's a tough question because, I mean, the economics of small wineries remain pretty tenuous. I mean, these guys that are working that way are not making money. I mean, they're doing it, as I said, because it's what they do. They're not... So, you know, how many young guys starting to work like that are going to be happy with the lifestyle that is not going to ever put a Mercedes in their garage? You know, it's to maintain that type of winemaking, really. I mean, I don't see it leading to commercial success. I don't see a trend.
Because it's heavy labor. And yields are lower.
Right. You know, there are larger wineries that have converted to biodynamie that are making commercial success, like growers in Sancerre, for example. I mean, you know who they are, who are working that way and making commercially successful wine and making a fairly large amount of money. Usually the wines are not particularly interesting. I mean, there really seems to be a lot of growers feel like there is this maximum size that an estate can be to really make handmade artisanal wine that has that taste of the soil, that really has that link to the terroir.
And if you were to say to someone, besides, you know, look at the website that you have and get a sense, what are some of the names of growers that you would point people to if they really wanted to get that sense of the taste of the terroir? Who are some of the kind of benchmark names that would come to mind for mm-hmm. you that you might want to pass on?
Well, there's so many. I mean, at this point, it's... I mean, if you started in Muscadet, I mean, you know who they are. And there are happily more now than there were 10 years ago. But, you know, there's Marc Olivier, there's Joe Landron at Louvetry, there's Bregion, there's Bruno Papin, and you know, Muscadet is sort of it's a favorite region for a lot of terroir lovers because, you know, the grape is sort of transparent. It's the Melon does not have a lot of varietal fruit character. Mm-hmm. So that what you get is largely a reflection of your terroir. So it's, you know, you can very easily taste the difference between the granite based wine, the wines based on schiste and Nice and so forth. People in Beaujolais that make terroir based wines. I mean, there's so many of them now. But again, for them, it's sort of a struggle. You know, it's not so easy. They're harassed by the INAO to make typique Beaujolais because sure. That's how they feel they're going to compete with the rest of the world.
Why don't we talk about what that means? I mean, there was Brune had a wine he had to declassify because of that. I mean, what happens when what is expected becomes not the vision of the young right. growers who are trying for more quality?
It's a big problem in France because largely the people that make those decisions are young bureaucrats.
Not
necessarily in
wine growers.
Well, some of them are wine growers, but they're relatively young. They don't have experience with wines before the 1960s that tasted differently.
Got it.
So their idea of what the appellation should present to the outside world as typicity is a modern, yeasted, chemically farmed, machine harvested wine.
So mediocrity in a way is kind of enshrined.
Right.
And then they say, well, this doesn't taste mediocre, so you can't call it the same as this.
Right. And the, you know, the commercial impetus for groups like that is to compete internationally with other areas of the world, which is insane. I mean, it's complete insanity to
expect. So you're saying the large commercial producers in a region may be competing not with the small growers in our region so much as they're competing with somebody in Australia or Chile or Argentina.
Right. The people of the INAO are worried about how are French wines going to compete in the international market. So they want the regions to have this typicity. They want Beaujolais to be thermo-fermented. They want it to be fleshier. They want it to be more aromatic, you know, which is... And so there's a lot of pressure on growers to work that way, and which Americans don't realize, perhaps, but it's very frustrating. There are growers over there that are so angry, you know, they're ready to quit because they don't want to put up with the harassment by the local authorities.
So it's come to that. I mean, there are some people who may stop making wine because of this.
I've heard a lot of them say that. I mean, just out of anger. So for a small grower to exist outside of the commercial wine world and to present wines that are Vin de France, Maison Brûlée in the Loire Valley, it's not Touraine or Chardonnay, it's Vin de France. Christophe Fouché, the same thing, Vin de France. Ducruz Nouveau is not a Beaujolais, it's a Vin de France.
Do the growers then usually make less money on that?
In reality, they don't, because the people they're selling to don't care.
Don't care.
But
that message has to be communicated.
That message is communicated to them, and it does, within France, there is difficulty in the marketplace if you're not AOC.
Got it. So if you don't have a dedicated clientele already, it can be very difficult to find the market for something that doesn't get the appellation. What are some of the other challenges you see in the market? I mean, what are some of the things that just make you want to hit your head up against the wall and say, like, this is silly? What if you could change a few things about the relationship between getting, you know, small growers' wines to
consumers? The three-tier system is there are good and bad things about it. On one hand, it enables people like Louis Dressner, let's say, to place their wines in many states in the country and have distribution, which is great.
So when you say three-tier, you mean the importer, distributor,
retailer or restaurant, yeah. But you know, the margins are important at each level, so that by the time the wine gets to the consumer, it can be at a price point which makes it difficult to introduce, let's say, you know, a small production natural wine to the American consumer.
Because so, everybody's taking a cut, so $10 becomes $28 by the time it hits the shelf.
It's, you know, it's frustrating, but it is sort of the economic reality of how it's going to work. And so the question is not, okay, so we're bringing wines directly, which enables us to offer them less expensively, which is great. But on any sort of real scale, it's difficult to expect that to work for a lot of people, because importers working with these small estates need distribution. And so, you know, the pricing, it's going to creep up. But, I mean, I have a lot of respect for what Louis Dressner does in that regard. They promote the wines very well. Their distributors generally work well to educate people in the different regions. So it's a frustration, the three-tier system, but I don't see it really changing that dramatically. You know, to those of us that are able to work directly to some degree, it's fine. And Joe Dressner was sometimes critical of our efforts to do that. And I'd say, Joe, look, this is strengthening the whole segment of the business. If we can offer more and more of these small estate wines at reasonable prices, we're going to draw more and more people into the market, and you're going to sell more wine, which is indeed what's happened. We do more business with Louis Dressner than ever, even though we're doing a lot of importing on our own through you know, a company here in New York. So,
how do you feel like the way that the technological interface has changed has allowed you to do what you want to do better?
It's been hugely important. When we opened the store, we had a website built by Robert Callahan, who was had been working for me at Garnett, who was very instrumental in
a brilliant guy.
And the site that he was working on with a few other people, Wine Therapy, was hugely important in reaching people around the country. So when we first built the site, Robert built it for us at Chamber Street. It was reaching out to that that group of consumers around the country. We didn't really see it as a tool in the sense that it has become in terms of using it as a catalog, as a resource, as everyday people in the neighborhood ordering online, which of course they do.
Because I mean, there's some things that come out and there's like a feeding frenzy, you know, where people are like, oh, there's 36 bottles left. You got to get in there now. I mean, Beaudry Rosé, I think, would be a good example. You just offered it and it was like the clarion call went out,
right.
You know? And then there's some things that are so limited at this point that it's like they can't even go out on an email right. offer because you'd have to send too many people rejection notices.
That's a problem. We try to avoid that, you know, putting things on the web that where the quantity is so small. I mean, that's an irritation, I mean, frankly, right. for people that see it and want it, and then it's gone. So
you don't want to return 100 phone calls with apologies.
Right.
And
but when we rebuilt the website maybe 5-6 years ago, our business increased dramatically because we were reaching so many more people with it.
And it is, as you said, a national audience. And sure. Do you think you would have been able to do what you do today without those kind of tools?
No. I mean, well, I shouldn't say that. Yes, we would, but it would have been limited to the New York area. I mean, it would have remained a much smaller business, but yes, we could have done it without the internet. Yeah. It would have been dependent upon effective advertising within New York. I mean, Garnett, for example, was spending huge amounts of money advertising in the New York Times every month. And Chamber Street does not spend a dime on print advertising. You know, we don't advertise whatsoever.
Some things online,
we have done in the past. Like. Yeah, we supported the Asimov column for a while online until they turned it into the living section, and you couldn't pinpoint the wine audience.
Right.
Now people approach us. You know, the big national search engines and advertising things approach us about working with them, and we say no. We're a niche. We have our niche. We don't need or want to have to deal with your more national distribution. But yeah, down the line, will our idea of that survive? It's hard to tell. I think so, because of the nature of what we're selling. I mean, it comes down to the wines we're selling, the winemakers we're representing. They don't fit into larger, whether it's Amazon or whatever, they don't fit into that. Maybe eventually there's a way that they will. Which might be good for everyone. I don't know. I think it's a ways down the road yet.
So because you're dealing with small quantities, it's like the large scale, people don't even have an interest in picking up, you know, 20 cases to sell, because that to them is more of an annoyance than it is. So, I mean, for you, you may not feel the pressure of, you know, like a online discounting model. Because it's just not affecting how you do business at all, really. I mean, it's not the same wines. Is that fair to say?
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, there are certain parts of the wine business that would be workable in that way, but not ours. I mean, you know, those people want you to give up a margin or X dollars per whatever. And, you know, we don't have room for that either. But it's, you know, like you say, it's because what we're selling is so limited in availability that we can't really work in that larger commercial model.
And there's not really a fear that, like, some large person or, you know, online entity would go to one of those small growers and say, well, if you give us a price cut on your wine, then we'll sell a bunch of it, because the grower themselves can't afford to give such a price cut. So it's not even a possibility, really, in a lot of ways.
If a guy has 2 or 3 or 4 hectare, he can't. It's like,
he's not going to give a 5 euro discount just to sell, you know, an extra 10 cases, because that's what the quantity is involved.
Yeah.
David, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I really appreciate it. I always learn something when I talk to you, and I really have a lot of respect and admiration for what you're doing at the shop.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here, and I hope this works out, and I hope that people will continue to support these kind of small estates, and I would like to be very encouraging for other people to get into the business, start businesses that focus on these kind of wines.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Scala has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's I-L-L, drinktothatpod.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.